Name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Christ is risen.
Truly.
We're going to talk about fidelity today. And with fidelity comes courage. Father Nicholas talked about it a little bit yesterday. He was citing a very good sermon of Metropolitan Filaret, which I will draw on to some extent. But mainly, I want to have some sort of application. If we think fidelity is a good thing, everybody thinks fidelity is a good thing. Everybody thinks courage is a good thing. How are you going to have those things? That's very important. Just talking about them as concepts, well, I don't think that's enough. We have some children, some babies here right now. A baby that doesn't know you is going to be afraid of you, right? And maybe even for a long time until they get to know you, until they see the mom and dad, think you're okay, and then they are comfortable with you from proximity, from being around you, right? It's the same thing with infants that partake of the mysteries. If their parents bring them to the mysteries from the very beginning, the children are happy and they are just overjoyed to have the mysteries. Sometimes when the mysteries come out, they run up as fast as they can to be in line to get the mysteries. And when they're old enough, you know, to finally walk and not be held in the arms, they're so proud. That's because of proximity. That's because they're around. That's because their mother and their father are modeling this for them, and this is what they know. So this is part of the answer to how you're going to have fidelity and courage in this day. And we'll talk about the gospel and some other things, but you have to apply it. If you don't apply the gospel, you might as well read the phone book. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you know the gospel backwards and forwards, if you have the whole Psalter memorized. If you don't live with fidelity to Christ, you're nothing, absolutely nothing. And in our day and age, we have people who are talking without fidelity, including clergy, including bishops. Now, I'll say some things that some of you might be shocked. Some of you already know me, so you won't be shocked because we've talked about these things. But to some of you, you might think he's being political. There's not one ounce of politics in what I'm about to tell you. There's Christianity in what I'm about to tell you. We have to have fidelity. We have to have courage. There's so many voices right now, even people wearing black robes and with panagias on their chest. And they're saying things that are ludicrous, that are not in fidelity to Christian life. We must be able to discern this, but the only way you discern this is by living in fidelity yourself, living with effort and with application, with priorities. If your priorities are out of whack, then there's a lot of other stuff that can happen. You can have people talk with oily words, right? That their words are smoother than oil, and yet they are darts, says the scripture. And all these smooth words, and so many say them, and people start to believe them. It's very easy to believe something when a lot of people say it, especially people who are supposedly believe the science, etc., and all these kinds of things that are said, thrown around like sledgehammers to try to make people comply to a certain way of thinking, to a worldly way of thinking. We are not worldly. We are Christians. We must live in a Christian way, and it's getting harder. It was easy until now. Basically, much of this century basically almost all of the time in this country, it's been pretty easy to be a Christian. Other parts of the world has been very hard. And right now in various parts of the world, it's very hard to be a Christian. You might lose your life. You might have your daughter kidnapped if you're a Christian in certain parts of the world. And now we're seeing that there's an apparatus, a worldwide apparatus, that could control people, that has the capability to do it, and it appears that some people have the will to use this apparatus. What are we going to do when things are less free? We better be doing the same stuff we're doing now, assembling in prayer, loving one another, saying our prayers, struggling to live the Christian life, knowing that there's only one thing that's important in life. That's it, nothing else, and that is eternal life, to be united with Christ, to become like him. We're already made in his image. We should be in his likeness. And that's a process that happens. And it's a hard process. And it's going to get harder. So we have to have courage. From fidelity comes courage. So let's talk about the myrrh-bearing women and what makes them so exceptional, even more exceptional than the apostles in this aspect. And then how can we become exceptional ourselves? Because I'm telling you, it's not going to get easier. It's going to get harder. And if you don't have an interior life, you're going to be swept away. I struggle with that idea because I know some loved ones are going to fall away. Do you know that? Do you understand that? Some people you know are going to be people you don't know in some period of time. May it be not for any of us, but it's going to happen. What are you going to do when it happens? If you don't have an interior life, you're going to have trouble, and you might go along with them. So let's talk about the myrrh-bearing women. They loved the Lord. They followed the Lord. They helped the Lord with everything. They took care of all the stuff, you know, make sure the meals were served and other things were done. The apostles were busy arguing about who's greatest and going out two by two and doing all that cool stuff. And the women were with the Lord. Lots of them. We named seven myrrh-bearing women, but there were probably more. And there was a whole entourage that traveled with Jesus, that loved him. And when Jesus was arrested, all the apostles fled except one. John stayed with him. But everybody else was afraid. They ran away. But the women didn't. They stayed with him. They were with him at the cross. Not only the Theotokos, Mary Magdalene, probably a whole group of them were there. And they were the only ones, besides Joseph and Nicodemus, who also did not flee. Or at least they gained courage. They fled at first. They were the only ones who knew where he was buried. Mark makes that notation that they beheld where he was laid. Why? Because of fidelity. Because they loved Jesus. And here he was on the cross naked, and then he was dead. And then the earth was dark. And their hope, they thought he was dead. They didn't think he was alive. But they couldn't part from him because of love. And so they saw where he was buried. And of course, there wasn't enough time to anoint him. And that was the custom. Myrrh and aloes and various things to help the body not smell and preserve the body somewhat. And there was not enough time because the Sabbath was so close. There was only enough time basically to kind of hastily wrap him in a sheet and put him in the tomb and then roll a stone across it. And then at the Sabbath, after the Sabbath was done, at the raising of the sun, probably first light, probably before the sun, the women were going to the tomb in order to anoint his body because of love, because of fidelity. They thought he was dead. They were going to the person they thought was dead, the one they loved, who they thought was dead. And they were going to go to five soldiers who probably would, maybe could kill them. Certainly they weren't going to be very agreeable to rolling the stone away. How was that going to happen? They didn't have any idea. But because of fidelity, because of love, because they had a relationship with Jesus, because it mattered to them, even though he was dead in their minds, they went. And of course, the stone had been rolled away. The angel announced to them that he was risen, and they believed. Now they were afraid. They're human. They were afraid, really, to tell this news because this news was so fantastic. But they believed. But there were several occurrences. It's kind of complicated. The evangelists don't make it easiest for us to find out exactly what happened on Sunday morning. They're not really interested with a precise historical record. I think they were writing. So aflame with love that they were not really concerned about exact details. So it's hard to piece it together. But there were several meetings of Jesus with the myrrh-bearing women. First the angel, and then they went away. Mary came back, the Theotokos. Jesus met with her. And then Mary Magdalene came back, and Jesus met with her. And there were other occurrences that possibly some of them were not written down. But they believed, and eventually they had enough courage to tell the apostles. What did the apostles say? We don't believe you. They didn't believe. And even after there were apostles that did believe, Luke and Cleophas on the way to Emmaus, they didn't believe. The whole way they were talking to Jesus. And because to them, Jesus was dead. Their hope was dead. They loved him. So they were still around, but he was dead to them. They didn't believe, even though he was there. It's mysterious. Why didn't they recognize him? Some people say he changed his form. I don't think that's it. It was just too impossible for them to be able to fathom that he was still alive. So they looked right at him. And of course his countenance was changed. He was in a perfected body, but he looked the same. He still had his wounds. I mean, somebody walking down the road with wounds, you'd kind of put two and two together, but they didn't understand. The women, because of their fidelity to Jesus Christ, they were the first to have the resurrection announced to them, the first to believe, and the first to be apostles. They were apostles to the apostles. So Metropolitan Philaret, I think he quotes our Metropolitan Anthony in a sermon. They were apostles to the apostles because of fidelity, because of love. So now how do we apply this to our life? Because if we don't apply it, like I said, it doesn't matter if you know things, but you don't do them. We live in an age, a terrible age now. I'm 62 years old, and I've never seen anything so terrible, where people call the truth a lie and the lie truth, where they call death life and life death, where people are rewarded for believing in death and calling it life, where death is actually made law. What a terrible time we live in. A hard time for our children. I know people that didn't have children because of this time. They might regret it now, I don't know. But there's sometimes a temptation for us, isn't there, as parents? What kind of world will our children have? What kind of world will our grandchildren have when we have bishops who are saying secular things and enforcing secular rules in their parishes? When we have bishops who, and I'll say some things, maybe you think they're political. They're not political. I don't want you to get caught up in this detail, but I'm going to still speak about it. Remember, you must have fidelity to Christ, which must mean you must have an inner life. And you must develop courage from this inner life. If you don't do that, you're done. When the temptations come, the tsunami is going to wipe you out. So that's the main point. But we can see this talk about coronavirus and the vaccine, a vaccine which came from the culture of death. Every single vaccine that is in this country, there are some in development in Europe, perhaps one will become available here. Every single one has been developed using the culture of death. And by that I mean the abortion industry. It is an industry. Just like people raise pigs and slaughter them, the abortion industry slaughters human beings and makes a profit. And politicians get elected because they are completely enslaved to this industry. So they give with one hand and they receive back with the other. This is the culture of death. No Christian can support this culture of death. It's not a political statement. It's just plain old, you don't kill people. You especially don't kill people that are completely innocent and can't defend themselves. You just don't. And you especially don't kill people and then use their parts as if it was just chemicals on a shelf for various things. That's what's happening in our day. Now, perhaps this is a little too much. Perhaps there's a child who's a certain age and hears this and becomes upset. I apologize if they do, but you know what? It's only going to get worse. I'll tell you that years ago, we were living in Indianapolis. My children were young, and Jenny is about to be 40. She was like 29. But she was very young. And we were like in a city, in a city for some sort of thing, you know, some sort of festival or whatever, and we're walking around. And Jenny, I remember she was asking me, "Daddy, why are those two men holding hands?" I didn't have an answer for it. That was like almost 40 years ago, okay? I didn't have an answer for it. And now it's just everywhere. It's in the air, right? Everywhere. It's in our schools. If your children are in public schools, I'll tell you, they are being indoctrinated with this. Many even Christian schools, supposedly quote-unquote Christian schools, are indoctrinating people with this stuff, with this complete garbage that we should identify ourselves as something other than children of God, made in His image to obtain His likeness. That somehow we should consider ourselves to be, I don't know, pick any kind of gender you want. Pretty much you can pick whatever you want. I mean, if you want to be an alien gender, you can be. You identify as that, but that's not identifying as something true. That's identifying as something that's disgusting. And I don't mean disgusting in terms, I don't want you to say, come away saying, Father Sam was disgusted with, you know, LGBTQ stuff. I'm disgusted with falsehood. That's what I'm disgusted with. Because what falsehood does is kills the soul. So all of this confusion, and your children are all in the middle of it, if they're in any public school, even many private schools, what are you going to do? What are you going to do about this? What are you going to do when we have bishops that are literally saying, if you're vaccinated, you can come to church and not wear a mask? That's obscene. They never mention, in these letters that I've seen two recently, and there's been others, they never mention that the vaccines come from the culture of death. Literally, fetal tissue has been cultured and used in either testing or development. I think in one of the cases, actual production. But the main vaccines that are being used right now, they're not being used for production of the vaccine. But in any case, the culture of death is pervasive. And literally people say, well, that's okay. These people, you know, these babies, they died in the 60s. And, you know, we have to get some good out of a bad thing. And all this kind of relativistic garbage. It is garbage. And it's garbage that infects the soul if people start believing it. And then some people, I don't know why they should care. I mean, the Pope has said, no, this is okay. We're against abortion and that's a bad thing, but you can use it for this. Just this. Sure, just this. Like really. Like really, when something evil has come into the world, you can use it just one time for one good thing. Is that really going to happen? Of course it isn't. Of course there's going to be more cells that are used for different purposes. The main cells that were used for the Moderna and the Pfizer were HEK293, kidney cells, from a baby that was aborted, selective abortion, most likely because the mother had rubella and they scared her to death and said, you know, we've got to kill your baby because your baby might have a problem. And then they harvested the cells. With the mother's permission? I don't know. Probably not. They didn't tell her? Okay. They probably didn't tell her how they aborted the baby either. Okay. So they didn't tell her. I mean, what do you expect? Our murderer is going to tell the truth? I mean, this is kind of easy stuff. This is not rocket science. If people murder, are they going to tell the truth? No. If the vaccine comes out of the culture of death, are people going to tell the truth about it? No. This is easy stuff. Okay, children understand if somebody's not reliable, then if they say one lie, they're going to say another. And yet we somehow don't get this. So there are bishops that are literally saying people should get vaccinated when it's part of the culture of death. Now, that's not even mentioning that since it's from the culture of death, this vaccine is very suspect. Actually, we call it a vaccine. It's not really a vaccine. It's an experimental drug treatment. Literally, that's what their literature says. It's an experimental treatment that has emergency authorization from that bastion of truth, our government. It must be true because they authorized it, right? So an experimental drug treatment that has had lots of problems, and we know that the media and the government, doesn't matter if it's Republican or Democrat, by the way. I mean, who was the main guy who pushed the vaccine to be created, right? Donald Trump, of course, now, you know, he's kind of forgotten, but he's part of this. He's part of this. And don't think that, you know, if all of a sudden you had, you know, the guy with red hair, that things would be all different. Orange hair, I guess it is, isn't it? It wouldn't be different. It wouldn't be different. How can we know what's true and what isn't? Well, it's pretty easy to know. You shouldn't kill people, right? You certainly shouldn't kill babies. You certainly shouldn't kill babies and then use their parts and sell their parts and profit from their parts. That's just disgusting. And no wonder that in California, I guess they have in the school program, they're trying to get the people to say prayers to Aztec gods who, of course, did human sacrifice. We do human sacrifice. I've been in front of places that do human sacrifice and prayed. I'll tell you, it's a hard thing to do. I stopped doing it because it was just too much. Because it was too normal outside, and yet 200 feet away from me, somebody was being murdered. So what are you going to do? You're going to just believe everything your bishops tell you? Not if they're talking to you about a vaccine and not saying a word about its origins and about how deadly it can be. By the way, there's some women here that are of childbearing age, of course, girls that are coming to puberty or, you know, young, not having had children yet. Do not give them the vaccine. Don't do it. If you've taken one, don't take the other one. Okay? Don't take the other shot. Because, you know, that's another lie. Oh, you're just going to get it twice. Are you serious? 3 years from now, we're going to have another round. And another round, another round. It's very dangerous for girls especially. I personally think it's likely to be dangerous for many people. But certainly it's from the culture of death. So I apologize, I might have spent a little bit too much time on this, because what I want you to do is come away with that I've got to have an inner life or else I'm going to get swept away. That's what I want you to come away with. And I want you to come away with such admiration for the myrrh-bearing women. Had such courage. It was dangerous to go to that tomb. And all they were going to do is anoint a dead man. Why would they want to risk their lives to do that? Because of love. Because of fidelity. They gave the Lord what they had. Many of you have heard me speak like this many times. I think it's one of the most important skills you can have in life. You give God what you have. You got to do that. You have to do that. You can't give him what you don't have. That's not possible. If you're not able to do something, you can't do it. But if you are able to do it, you have to do it. You must do it. That's why fasting is so important. Because for most of us, we can fast. Some of you might have troubles, all right, I understand. But if you can fast and you don't, oh boy, you got troubles. Because you're not giving the Lord what you can give him. You must give him what you can give. The great miracle that happens when you give the Lord what you can, even if it's the tiniest thing, even if it's literally having chicken instead of hamburger on a day, or fish instead of meat, even if it's something small, even if it's just instead of, you don't say your prayers at night, but you at least make the sign of the cross over your bed, or you say the Our Father, even if it's a tiny thing, even if it's you get angry at somebody, but then you ask forgiveness. The smallest thing that you can do, God magnifies it, and then you're able to do more. That whole concept is throughout this entire period, this Paschal period. All of the Gospels, on Sunday especially, are about enlightenment and that process of enlightenment. Thomas gave the Lord what he had. He didn't believe. He didn't believe at all. He said, I don't believe. I won't even believe unless I see him and I literally touch him. But he hung around because of love. He shouldn't be commended for saying he didn't believe, but that he hung around? Yes. And the Lord then gave him according to his need. Said, go ahead and touch me. The myrrh-bearing women, they didn't need that kind of proof. They had more faith. It said here that Joseph became bold. What a statement, huh? He was scared. He was a member of Pharisees. I mean, he could lose a lot if people knew that he believed in Jesus. And then he became bold. He gave the Lord what he had. He had a tomb. He gave the Lord the tomb. We'll see lots of examples. The blind man and the paralytic. All these examples of enlightenment happening in degrees because people give the Lord what they have. Maybe it's not much. Maybe you don't think you have much to give to the Lord. Well, if you have two mites to give to the Lord, that's enough. Just give your two mites. And the Lord will consider it to be everything, to be all of your living, to be all of your life. And then you will be magnified. God will help you. So I've gone on a little while because this is a deeply emotional subject for me. We have tough times coming. I want you to be ready. I don't want you to be ready politically. I don't want you to buy a double, you know, shotgun 22 something. I don't want you to buy, you know, necessarily food and have it stored up. You can do all those things. But that's not the way I want you to be ready. The way I want you to be ready is that you have courage because you have fidelity. So if you're not saying your daily prayers, boy, you're in trouble. You got to start doing that. And, you know, if you're terrible at it, then okay, just get a little bit better. How about that? If you're not fasting, how about getting a little bit better? If you don't go to church very often, get better, you know, because you need to. If you're not going to church on Saturday, it's a wonderful congregation today, but it was about one third of that or one quarter of that last night. It should be everybody. Try. I know some people, you know, you got this, you got that. Maybe you can't make it always happen. Maybe it's hard to get into that kind of groove. Maybe you can say, I'm going to go once a month, but I'm going to do it all. And you give the Lord what you have, and the Lord will magnify it. So this is what you must do to be ready for what's coming. I don't know exactly what's coming. I'm not a prophet. I don't have any insight into actual, you know, future events. But it's coming. And people are going to be disbelieving. And they're going to be supposedly Christians, but not really having the power of Christianity. They're still going to be going to church, but not having the power of Christianity. And that's what I want you to have. That's what I want me to have. And I want to transmit it to you, to my children, to my grandchildren. I don't want any of you to be lost. And I'm sure that's the same case for you. You don't want any of your loved ones to be lost. You can't convince them by white papers and by stuff. And there's plenty of that stuff out there. And it's pretty scary, to be honest with you. But that's not how you convince people. You convince people by being a Christian, by living with fidelity, by taking a page from what the myrrh-bearing women did and just making sure you're always around Christ. Even when things are really hard, even when you get down about things, even when Bishop says another crazy thing and enforces it with an iron fist, even when there's another lockdown, I think it doesn't take a prophet to say that there will be other lockdowns. That doesn't take any skill at all to know that. What are we going to do in that case? What are we going to do? We might have to modify some things a bit, but I'll tell you what, we still should be gathering and worshiping. We still should be partaking of the Eucharist. We still should be serving the vigil. Even if it's in secret, we still should be doing it. But we have to have courage. We have to have fidelity, or else we're going to get wiped out. So that's the main message. It's gone on for half an hour. I apologize. It's been a little bit long. But that's the main message. Cleave to Christ. Get a better interior life for the sake of you and for the sake of your loved ones. God bless you.